It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Probably a very common misconception that people have is, I don't have to come to an interrogatory, just as I didn't have to come to a warrant in debt in order to get the judgment. On the first hand, as to a warrant, the debtor is correct. They do not have to come. But on an interrogatory, it's different. There is a requirement that they actually appear if they have been served the papers. And that includes simply being left on the door of their residence. If they don't come in, Marty, then they, the debtor, are subject to a show cause or a contempt citation issued by the court through the commissioner that says you now have to come in under penalty of fine or, worse yet, a possible arrest warrant called a capias, which is Latin for seize the person. And they will be required and under force to come in and answer the questions about what assets they may have.
Private attorney Mike Bellotto talks about the collections process in Virginia and explains the rights of creditors as well as the protections for debtors, and the many things you need to know if you are being hounded by a debt collector are explained during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 136, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Representative Austin Scott of Georgia, a Tea Party favorite and president of the House Republicans freshman class, introduced his first bill earlier this month. It is one sentence long and, in its entirety, says, "Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America, in Congress assembled, that the Legal Services Corporation Act is repealed." This is a transparent attempt by Representative Scott to defend a company in his district that discriminates against U.S. citizens in favor of Mexican migrant workers. Scott introduced the bill abolishing legal services exactly 3 days after it became public that Georgia Legal Services had won a U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission determination that Hamilton Growers, quote, engages in a pattern or practice of regularly denying work hours and assigning less favorable assignment to U.S. workers in favor of H-2A guest workers, and also engages in a pattern or practice of discharging U.S. workers and replacing them with H-2A guest workers. During his successful campaign to unseat moderate Democrat Jim Marshall, Scott ran a tough-on-immigration message saying that Congress had ignored its responsibility to secure U.S. borders and that making it more difficult to obtain jobs here would curb the influx of illegal aliens. Given that, you'd think Scott would have sided with the 17 U.S. citizens in Georgia who claimed Hamilton Growers illegally dumped them in favor of Mexican workers on H-2A visas. Georgia Legal Services took their case, one of three active cases it has against big growers in Scott's district, and on July 29, it put out a news release announcing victory. On August 1, Scott introduced his bill, which would end the government program, dating back to the Nixon administration, of providing legal assistance to low-income people pursuing equal justice under the law. Women seeking protective orders against abusive partners, homeowners fighting foreclosure or predatory lending, and similar civil actions. Phyllis Holman, executive director of Georgia Legal Services, said it's common for growers to call their members of Congress for help when a legal services client sues them. But as one of the American plaintiffs put it, "We worked hard at our jobs and really wanted the work, but Hamilton didn't want Americans to work in their fields. Americans, after all, would be more likely to know the laws and to complain if they're being exploited. Instead, Scott chose to side with a large employer of foreign migrants in his district against his out-of-work constituents." With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Packard Norfolk Incorporated versus Miller. In February 1955, H.J. Miller, a Norfolk physician, bought a Packard automobile after the salesman promised him the car would be in perfect condition, thoroughly checked, gone over carefully, and in as good running condition as it could be. The car broke down after 180 miles when the automatic choke blade stuck. Dr. Miller tried to return the car a month after purchase. When the dealer would not take it back, he sued, claiming the car did not perform as promised by the salesman. The Circuit Court and the Supreme Court of Virginia agreed and granted damages, holding that the car did not perform as promised. The courts also held that the false representations made by the salesman were fraud in the procurement because they were matters of material fact made for the purpose of inducing the buyer to buy the car. The fraud made the entire contract void. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Packard Norfolk Incorporated versus Miller is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Tell us your name and where you're from.
Hello, my name is Barry, and I'm from Richmond, Virginia. The question that I had this week basically is, if you have an outstanding credit card debt, which basically you have two or three, you know, credit cards you haven't paid on the while, they're basically delinquent, and you are unemployed, what would be the best way to try to get on top of that and basically to try to get something done about that? Because by your creditors calling you, having to share with them that information, they still want you to some way pay that debt.
Well, Barry, that's an excellent question. And we get that a lot. And I have a list of rules that I give folks in that situation. The first rule is that you have the same problem that's faced by millions of people. You have more expenses, bills, and debts that you have money to pay them. And because of that, your only choice is to pay your most important bills, expenses, and debts first, and your least important last or not at all. It's your money. It's not your creditor's money. You decide how to spend your money, not your creditors. And you spend your money the way that's best for you, not the way that's best for your creditors. So you spend your money on your most important expenses first. Usually that means rent, utilities, food, clothing, medical care, transportation, other ongoing monthly expenses. And really your least important expenses are your credit cards, your old medical bills, your old utility bills, and other debts where if you don't pay them, nothing can be taken from you. Now, in my opinion, in this point, you have nothing useful to say to your creditors, and they have nothing useful to say to you. They're not interested in why you can't pay. They just want your money. And they have no better way to get your money than to try to scare or shame or intimidate you. So my advice is don't let them. When you answer the phone, as soon as you know it's a creditor or a debt collector, my advice is hang up the phone. If they call again, hang up the phone and do this as often as you need to until they stop calling. Now, if they send you letters, notices, and bills, you don't have to reply. You don't even have to open or read them. You can just toss them in a paper grocery sack and put the sack in the closet. Now, if you don't pay a credit card bill or some other debt, the worst thing that can happen to you is a creditor could file a lawsuit and get a judgment against you. A lot of people are afraid of that. But a judgment's nothing more than a piece of paper at the courthouse that says you owe someone some money. It doesn't collect itself. It has to be collected by legal action. And there are four ways that judgments are collected. Two are quick and easy and common, and two are long and hard and very rare. The quick and easy and common ones are to garnish your income or to garnish your bank account. But if you're working part-time and taking home less than $290 a week, that can't be garnished. Also, government benefits, pensions, child support can't be garnished. So if you have no income that can be garnished and the money in your bank account is also from income that can't be garnished, we call you collections proof. You're in very little danger of losing any income or property. The other two ways to collect a judgment are to sell some of your personal property to collect the judgment or to file a second separate lawsuit to sell a house or land that you own. But most of the personal property that you own is automatically protected. Selling a house and land by filing a separate lawsuit is even rarer than that. So these things are not really worth worrying about.
Well, thank you for that information. You sure have shined a beautiful light in a dark place. And the information that you have given is going to also help a lot of other people that are in the same situation. So I feel a lot better about it, and thank you. You've been very enlightening about the information. I'm going to pass it on to others. And you have a good day now.
Thank you for being on the show. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here with private attorney Mike Bellotto at his new office at the corner of East Carey Street and 3rd Street, and we are going to be talking about the collections process in Virginia. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hello, Marty.
Mike, there are a lot of people who believe that they can have their wages garnished or their bank account garnished just because they owe a debt without a judgment even being taken against them. Would you like to set the record straight on that?
Sure. Too many people think it's just a simple process of finding a piece of paper and going out and starting their collections. It's more involved. They first have to go to court in order to get a court order saying that the money is owed, and to specifically describe how they owe the money, how they are owed the money, and also the specific amount. And once they've gone to court and had a trial in front of a judge or gotten the judge to enter a default judgment where the person who owes the money doesn't show up, then they can begin the process of actually collecting the money.
Now, let's assume that the creditor has gotten a judgment, either by default or after a trial. What's the first thing that the creditor usually does to try to collect that judgment, to get information to collect that judgment?
Normally, the information that the creditor is going to use has already been obtained from the person who owes the creditor the money. Because if the creditor has done a good job of, at the very start, getting that information when the money was loaned or when the debt before the debt was incurred, they will oftentimes have where the debtor works, where the debtor may bank, where the debtor lives, and other contact information such as that. So with that information already in hand, the normal creditor will then take that information. If there's a place of employment or if there's a bank account known, they first have to wait at least 10 days before they can do anything, because for the 10 days after the court has given the judgment, the debtor has a right to appeal the case. But after that 10 days, if there has been no response from the debtor, there's still no effort to communicate, there's no effort to try to satisfy the debt, the creditor can take that judgment, that piece of paper, and then having it in hand, go to the same court where the judgment was entered and say, I'd like to issue a garnishment against either where they work or against the bank account. That's the normal first step.
And can you explain for us sort of step by step how the wage garnishment process works?
On a wage garnishment, your creditor is going to file a form called a garnishment form with the clerk of the court where the judgment was obtained. The clerk, in turn, is going to serve that paper on two different people. The one person, of course, is going to be served on the debtor, the person who does owe the money per the order of the court. And the second person involved in that garnishment process is the employer. And that employer will have, is also known as the garnishee. That employer will then receive the papers and be told, you now have instructions here attached with this form, which are telling you that you need to take out a certain amount of money from that employee's payroll every pay period.
And how long does this wage garnishment typically last?
On a wage garnishment, if you're the creditor, you'd like to make that wage garnishment probably run from no less than 90 days, but it can last no longer than 180 days. So that's either 3 months and up to as much as 6 months. And you might say, why would that be 3 months to 6 months? Because you want to ensure that when you're paying as much as $60 to $90 for the court cost in filing such a paper as a garnishment, which is actually coming out of your pocket as the creditor, you want to be sure you maximize the dollar recovery, which means you want to make sure enough money is taken out of that person's paycheck each pay period to probably recover most of your money, or at least as much as possible.
Now, what if the judgment debtor is working only part-time, especially at a minimum wage? Are there certain wage protections that are allowed there?
Yes, Marty. On the debtor's side, the debtors cannot have their wages garnished unless they are making at least $290 per week after taxes. They are not going to be subject to a garnishment. They are those rules of protecting to make sure the debtor does not have their necessary monies at least taken out of their paycheck.
You also talked about a bank account garnishment. Would you lead us through that process? How does that work?
It's similar in the sense that the creditor will take the information from the judgment, give it to the clerk, and have the clerk then issue the garnishment form, again, to both the debtor who had the judgment entered against him or her, as well as to the bank where the monies are believed to be on deposit. Upon receipt of those monies, the bank is going to freeze that bank account. And that means that the person, again, who is the debtor, is going to watch their mail to be sure that they understand that as of that moment, the debt has been put against their account, and therefore they cannot use any of the money in that bank account until the order from the court releases it or there's been some hearing on it.
Now, what if the money is in the account is from some exempt source, for example, government benefits like unemployment compensation, or maybe it comes from those part-time wages of less than $290 per week after taxes? What's the debtor supposed to do at that point?
There are forms attached with the garnishment that the debtor receives that tells them about a number of exemptions, as you pointed out, so that if there's only Social Security money that is put into that account or only disability income in that account, and or the amount of money is not sufficient because of what's for child support or the like, then the debtor should go immediately to the court and file an exemption form and ask for a hearing as soon as possible to get the court to release those funds and not wait the 30, 90, 120 or more days to get that exemption and that release granted.
And how long does a bank account garnishment typically last? I mean, you said wage garnishment 3 to 6 months. Is that the same for bank account garnishment, or is it shorter than that?
It would probably be shorter, Marty, because the creditor is not going to continue to get money. The debtor, having had the money frozen the first time, is very unlikely to continue having money placed into that account. So a garnishment of a bank account will be normally 30 to 60 days approximately. It'll be a return back to the court and an answer given.
Now, we've talked about situations where the judgment creditor knows where the judgment debtor works or banks or has money. What about the situation where the creditor may not know that? What's the creditor do then?
If you have an address but may not know where the banking information or may not know where the employment information, the creditor can take the steps to file another court form called a debtor interrogatory. That's another cost, which again, like the garnishment, will cost the creditor some money, approximately again $50 to $60 to file. It'll command, and by summons, that the debtor actually come in front of a special officer of the court called a commissioner to answer questions about what assets the debtor, he or she, may have.
And by command, is this a situation where the debtor absolutely must show up? And if so, what happens if the debtor doesn't show up?
Probably a very common misconception that people have is, I don't have to come to an interrogatory, just as I didn't have to come to a warrant in debt in order to get the judgment. On the first hand, as to a warrant, the debtor is correct. They do not have to come. If they admit to the money being owed, there is no requirement that the debtor appear just to have the judgment entered against him or her. But on an interrogatory, it's different. There is a requirement that they actually appear if they have been served the papers, and that includes simply being left on the door of their residence. If they don't come in, Marty, then they, the debtor, are subject to a show cause or a contempt citation issued by the court through the commissioner that says you now have to come in under penalty of fine or, worse yet, a possible arrest warrant called a capias, which is Latin for seize the person. And they will be required and under force to come in and answer the questions about what assets they may have.
So that's that rare situation where you can be arrested, not because you didn't pay the debtor judgment, but because you didn't come to court to answer the questions.
That's right. Some people will oftentimes ask me, don't they have to pay the money? Can't they be forced to pay the money? Doesn't the court require them to pay the money? The answer is no, none of those. We do not have debtors' prisons in this country. But they can, as you suggest, be forced to come in and answer the questions about their assets. And they shouldn't have any fear of doing that if they do not have any money because, again, if they don't have anything, they cannot be forced to pay that which they don't have.
Now, a lot of people are also afraid that their personal property might be sold to pay a judgment. Can that happen? And if so, how common is that?
It's not very common, but it can happen. If you know, as a creditor, that the person has a vehicle or has personal property that is something you can touch and lay hands on, you can ask that the sheriff, where that person lives, be given a paper to go out and inventory and take a cataloging and registry of what that property is. And that's good for 90 days in order to then first give a record of it. Your property may be seized, but I emphasize may because the creditor has the additional obligation if they do find property that they would like to sell, such as a car or a truck or some other vehicle. First thing the creditor will have to do is satisfy that there's no existing liens that might be in front of that creditor that will get paid first. And even if they satisfy themselves of that, they still, as a creditor, have to put up a bond, and the bond must be equal to that value of the vehicle or at least of the judgment that they're going to be trying to collect on, and then putting that bond in the hands of a sheriff, the sheriff will seize the vehicles for a sale.
And the last thing that people are really afraid of course, is that if they have a judgment against them, their house could get sold out from under them to pay the judgment. Again, can that happen? And if so, how common is that?
It can happen where the creditor has a debt owed to them for a credit card bill or for some other loan that's been made. The creditor can go out and try to sell the house, but they also must stand behind any other creditors who have superior liens on that same property. So the sale of property, the real property we're talking about, the real estate in the house, is not as likely under that situation.
Well, this has been very informative. We have been speaking with private attorney Mike Bellotto about the collections process in Virginia from his new law office at the corner of East Carey Street and 3rd Street. Thank you so much, Mike, for being on the show.
It was a pleasure, Marty. Thank you very much.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 23, which deals with educational institutions. Christopher Reeve, the actor who played Superman, became a quadriplegic after being thrown from a horse in competition in Virginia. He required a wheelchair and breathing apparatus for the rest of his life. He lobbied on behalf of people with spinal cord injuries and for human embryonic stem cell research. In 2005, a year after his death, the General Assembly enacted Code of Virginia Section 23-286.1, the Christopher Reeve Stem Cell Research Fund. But the code goes on to state that no money from the fund may be provided to any entity that conducts human stem cells research from stem cells obtained
from human embryos. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral for, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. If you're uninsured, get hospital care, and receive a hospital bill or lawsuit, don't despair. You may not owe as much as claimed or may not owe anything at all. Join us next week when Peyton Whiteley, attorney with Legal Services of Northern Virginia, reveals the new and surprising defenses to hospital debt collection. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.
My Lord.